Thank you. I wish I could have got the big room. That would have been nice. So I don't know if I can see all of you, but thanks for being here today. So I'd like to, if you would join me, I'd like to open up a prayer this afternoon. So let's pray. Dear Lord, we just thank you for the opportunity to gather this afternoon as Christian educators across all different grade levels, with our students that we left yesterday to come here today, that you would just bless the time that we have this convention, also bless the time that we have here in the next a little less than an hour, that the things we talked about, discussed, might be from your word, spoken as truth, and we just pray that those things that are difficult in our school communities, in our classrooms, that you would give us the wisdom and discernment, would help us to move forward in those things as well. Bless the time we have, we ask this all in Jesus' name, amen. All right, so just a very quick little background in case you have no idea who I am. I have been teaching at Unity for 31 years. I taught at Sioux Center Christian Middle School for 3 years prior to that. And so I teach all seniors, and my kind of official position now, I guess, is the director for spiritual life, which is lots of different things. But I really, really enjoy my job. And one of the ways that I get to sort of carry out my work is through community things, parents, and even people outside of our school community to say, what does it mean to take faith into all areas of life? And I think that you have probably found in your school as well that it's not just anymore just about the students in your class. It's about their families as well. So we're teaching families, parents, kids. It's a lot. And it's different than when I started in education for sure. So in the very short time we have today, what I'd like to try to accomplish is two things. First of all, to give you a sense of how I try to sometimes use story to teach a specific item or issue or concept. And then to talk a little bit more in the second part about how the stories our kids are hearing outside of our classrooms are influencing what happens in our classrooms. And that's also for our families and our communities as well. So I'm gonna use three very short stories. Most of you are sitting by someone, so you'll have a chance to do a quick little, like, what do you think with your neighbor if you want to. And so this is all related to family stuff. Now, these originally took place a long time ago, and some of you will get that by how the story goes. So these aren't recent stories. First one's this one. A student you have and their family, the daughter comes home one day and says to her mother, Mom, I love my boyfriend. I know that we're going to get married someday. She's 17, okay, just so that you know. And I know we're going to get married someday. I really, really, believe that God has put us together. And all my friends agree. Of course, that's the main thing in high school is if your friends agree, right? So all my friends agree. They think we're perfect together. And so I just want to know that you like him. Yeah, we like him. Okay, what else? Well, I really love him a lot, and I believe that if you love somebody, I really think it's okay that if you love somebody and you know you're going to marry them, that it's okay then that you have a sexual relationship with them. I mean, I looked in the Bible like twice, and I didn't see anything that told me I was wrong, so I think that's okay. And, of course, the parents are like, what in the world? Because these are your parents in your school community, probably, most likely. And so, and as a parent, the parents say, well, is that it? Well, no, not quite. I know I want to be responsible, so the best way for me to be responsible is to start using birth control, to go on birth control pill. That's what I want to do. And mom and dad, I can't pay for it. I can't afford that. This is where the story is dated. Some of you will pick up on that. Can you help me pay for it, please? Because I can't afford it. And parents, plural, have a stable marriage, and their daughter just drops this. I want this. This is what I want. And I need you to help me with this. Because I believe it's okay to love my boyfriend in this way. So she heads back to her room to watch Hannah Montana. And you have to decide as a parent what you're going to do. Right? So I'll give you two options. Your options are, no, we're not going to do this. Or, yes, we are. There's your choices, okay? So in 20 seconds, just with your neighbors, yes or no? All right. I won't even ask you what you said, but I will let you guess at what my students say when I tell this story. I've told this story for a long time. Some of you in this room might remember this story being told in your class. Yes? Possibly? Okay. There's another part to this story, because you also have a son. Your son, very different from your daughter, your son, he's not really interested yet in dating, because he's a sophomore in high school. He's 16. And his lifestyle, the things he's interested in, really not much to do yet with dating. He hangs out with his buddies, and they like to have a good time. You know this. Okay, you're already aware of this. Unlike your daughter who dropped a bomb on you out of nowhere, you've been kind of waiting for this one from your son, because you kind of are in the back of your mind. You know this is happening. But on weekends, he goes out with his buddies, and when he hangs out with his friends, you know, there tends to be some drinking involved. You hope everything's okay, but you don't know for sure. And you have a hard time bringing this up because, unfortunately, you have been open with your kids and they know that you did this when you were in high school. And now that's the elephant in the room that you really don't know how to deal with. Because you know your son's going to say, well, you did it. And you're like, yeah, but you can. You know, so he says, listen, I want to be responsible. I don't want to get in trouble with the police. I don't want to get in trouble with somebody getting hurt and so on. That I want to be responsible, but you know I'm already doing this. Your daughter hasn't started what she is asking for. Your son is already doing this. So what he asks for is like, listen, Mom, Dad, all I'm asking for is a place to be. I just want a place to be. I just want you to give us the back 40, the pole barn. We have a lot of those in Hudsonville. That's all we want. That's all we want. I'm not asking. You can literally take our keys away so you know where we are all the time. Just give us a place to be. You can even check on us if you want to. I don't care. I just want a place to be. That's what he asked for. Okay? 20 seconds. Tell your neighbor what you're going to do. Yes or no? We're going to give you the back 40. We are not. Response I get in my classes as well. These are all seniors who get these situations. And one of the questions I do ask them is did anybody, and you don't need to say, all right, and I won't put you on the spot, did anybody vote differently with the son than with the daughter? And I say to my students, that's totally up to you. You can do that because you're the parent. But I've also said, like, good luck with that, because that's going to be a problem with one of your two kids. But that is certainly your prerogative to say yes to one or the other. You're the parent. So, I will take you out of your family for just a minute. I'll put you in the mind of a high school kid. All of you were in high school at one point. And so now, you and your eighth grade buddies back in middle school, you decided after hearing a high school teacher come to your chapel and talk about what high school is going to be like and how to avoid certain things in high school, you and your eighth grade friends kind of made a friend pact that you weren't going to get involved with some of the things that some people get involved with in high school that stumble them up a little bit. Not the party and the drinking, you know, the drugs, the smoking, the vaping. You're not going to do it. You all agreed in eighth grade. Ninth grade, that was pretty easy for your group. Tenth grade, things start to change. Because a few of the people in the group are like, come on, we should just go. We don't have to do anything. Let's just go. And one of those people is like, no. We said no. We said no. But people start to peel off. Any high school teacher in here knows this is a yearly reality in high school. So junior year comes around, and most of the people from eighth grade that have said, like, we're not doing this, are now involved in this. They're still friends of yours, but they're not really hanging around with you on the weekend so much anymore. So the summer between junior and senior year is not very fun at all. You just kind of alone, you work, you go home, because your friends are doing other stuff. And senior year is like, oh great, senior year, it's not going to be very fun. So you go through your senior year, and really, the friends are, your former friends are doing their own thing. They're kind of off doing whatever, and you're not, you're at home. But around Halloween, right about now, you get that friend, that one person gets a call, and it's late at night, and it's the former friend group who seems to be desperate for help. And they're out somewhere in the middle of nowhere. Kind of stuck, they got no good way to get home, they're worried about getting caught, they're worried about getting in trouble with their coaches, their teachers, their parents. Can you come pick them up? I need you to pick me, can you come pick us up? And this person does not want to do that. It's late at night, their parents, but even against their better judgment, maybe they go pick them up. And the friends are, oh, we will never do this to you again, ever. But I run New Year's, happens again. Same situation. And against maybe they're better, they will pick them up. Happens again, right around winter break. And then I make my students make a choice. You're either going to pick them up every single time the rest of the school year and into summer, or you're going to be like, I'm out. I'm done. No, sorry. Figure it out. I said no, I don't like this, I don't want to do it. I'm out. So you're going to pick them up every time now because you've done it twice already, or you're done. 20 seconds. Yes, I'm always going to. No, I'm out. What would you do? Tell your neighbor. All right. Now, we don't have the time to talk about this in the way that I would talk about this in my classes. But in my senior Bible class, this is about a day and a half conversation with the conversations that happen as a result of these three stories. And I tell a more extended version of the story as well. And it's not even as much about what they decide. I wonder why they decided what they do. So the story gets them to think about situations that some of them actually have been in class, and many of them will be in their lives. What are you going to do, but why are you going to do what you do? And I would suggest to you that the stories are, they're obviously different stories, but they're all the same. They're really all the same, and they're sort of where they fall back on. Your why is going to fall back on something. And if a student says more often to the stories like, I have to do this for my friend, I have to do this for my daughter, I have to do this for my son, the reason is because, well, I love you so much, I could never see anything bad, I don't want anything bad to happen to you. So I love you too much to let you fail or get in trouble or to get hurt or to get whatever. I love you too much. And so I just can't. I can't let you experience that kind of hardship. And I think that is very, that is a very, very heavy cultural version of what love is. Because the stories are all about love. They're really about love. And if you believe in this expression, then probably your answers lean more towards, well, I have to do this. I have to, because I love you. And if you love someone, you'll do anything for them, including something that maybe isn't very good for them. So I think you would agree, you don't need to raise your hands. This is a cultural understanding of what it means to love. Love means do anything. And frankly, any English teacher in here would say, like, that's one of the dumbest things ever to say, is love is love. That's like saying a chair is a chair, right? It just makes no sense. But it's obviously a very impactful cultural statement. It's used all the time. So love is love. So it means, love means I do whatever it takes. Well, probably more of you go with a 1 Corinthians 13 approach to love, which gives it a definition, which gives it a border, which gives it a boundary. Love is patient. Love is kind. And any one of you in here who's a parent knows, and as a Christian school teacher you know as well, sometimes the most loving thing to do and the most difficult thing to do at the same time is to tell somebody no, no. Because I have a reason for why. And 1 Corinthians 13 gives a why. Why? Because the Bible tells me so. So the stories are about love, and they're good stories to talk about with kids, to get them to think about the reason, but the stories all point back to love, and to get them to think about it in a way that maybe they haven't thought about it outside of themselves, but a story that they may have been part of. So I just think that there are so many things that occur in our lives that are possibilities for stories that we tell to teach a very important biblical truth. And one of the most important biblical truths I believe right now to teach our students is, what is the definition of love? What does it mean to really love somebody? Because there are so many bad understandings of love in the culture, and there's so much good that comes from the Bible when it talks about how to love somebody. So we'll talk more about that. And whatever I show you up here, I just want to be really clear about this. I know a lot of you in here, but some of you don't know me personally. I'm not throwing anybody under the bus, but I'm just giving you examples from the culture to get you to think about, like, how am I going to use this in my classroom? I say that because the slide I'm about to show you you're a big T. Swift fan, if you're a Swiftie, like, okay, that's fine. But this is from her Instagram, and so speaking my truth. There's another cultural example of how we understand what love is. Love is about what I say. I define what true actually is, my truth, and your authentic self. You do you. They point back to the individual, and it teaches them how do we know what love is? If love really goes out and boomerangs right back, it starts and ends with me, right? Speaking my truth. And that's not an anti-Taylor Swift thing. She just represents a culture that speaks this language all the time. So I always say to my kids when I say something cultural like this, send your hate mail to dleinster@unitychristian.org. So if they want to push back, I don't ever get them, but they could. So this is a book that we are using at Unity right now in terms of our chapel theme, Faithfully Different, but also a way of thinking about worldview. So from the book, those four secular messages, as we go through the stuff we talked about today, I want you to think about how those things sort of unfold, even in the lives of our students in school, even in grade school students. I don't know how many grade school teachers are in here, but it's not their fault, so to speak, but they're the products of a culture that sort of promotes this. So feelings are the ultimate guide. No one can tell you how you feel, but feelings are how you decide. So love is based on feelings. A question to ask your middle school or high school students is about love. Love is a feeling primarily, or love is a choice primarily? They're both involved, but one has to lead. What is it? And a lot of high school students, they want it to be love is a feeling, but they can't kind of argue their way out of the fact that love is actually a choice. And I say, none of you are married in my class or in your classes yet, probably. So are there days when you are married that you are going to not particularly care for your spouse because of how they acted that day, when you won't like your spouse very much? Yep, because I say, I'm that guy. I'm sure there are days that my wife doesn't like me very much. But I know she still loves me, because that's a choice. She has to choose that every single day. Love as a feeling kind of comes and goes. I feel this way today. That's why middle school relationships are so fascinating to me, right? Because you can absolutely want to marry that person, after gym class, and then hate their guts by the end of the day, right? That's total middle school. Any middle school teacher is like, yep, totally, right? The second one, happiness is the ultimate goal. The question to ask high school students is it God's primary desire for you to be happy? Yes or no? The culture would say, the whole point of life is just to be happy. And that reflects in the way you hear people tell their stories. Judging is the ultimate sin. High school kids, probably middle school kids today as well. The worst thing you can do is to be called judgmental. You can't make a judgment. Who are you to say, who died and made you king? You can't tell me what to do. You can't judge in our culture. It's the ultimate sin. But try to actually live your life without making a judgment. You can't do it. You've made judgments today. Some of you decided who you're going to ride with to CEA and who you weren't going to ride with, perhaps based on your own personal safety concerns. I don't really know, right? That was a judgment that you made. Doesn't mean you hate the person you didn't ride with? No, well, maybe, I don't know, but it probably didn't. But that's the idea. And then God's the ultimate guess. Nothing can be known for sure. You just can't know. God's a guess. And so if he's a guess, then nothing is for sure. There's no standard. And that's something you have to be aware of, I think, as well with this. So as a result of these four things, I'm going to show you a slide here that just gets you to think about something that I hear more of, probably just because I'm getting a little older I've been taught for such a long time. This came from a student. Okay, and the student said to me about a topic I'll tell you specifically. Well, I don't agree with that. They said it in class. I don't agree with that. I said, well, what do you mean? Well, I just don't think that's right. I don't think that's true. Okay, well, let's talk about that. So we did. And the topic was sex before marriage. And their comment after I showed them, here's God's design for marriage. Here's God's design for sexual intimacy with marriage. I don't agree with that. Is it your decision? Do you get to decide that? Do you have to believe something is true in order for it to be true? Well, no, you don't have to. I always say to my students, you can choose not to believe in gravity either. That's up to you. But the day you fall off a ladder, you'll be a convert on the way down. It's just true. So ultimate reality is, and it's truth, it always wins. Truth always wins. But that is a sentiment that, again, I blame the kid less than I blame the culture that produced a statement like that. And I know that this young man would profess to be a Christian, 100%. But his idea was like, well, I don't agree with that. I don't think I have to follow that rule. That's not for you to tell me that I can't. I don't agree with that. So there was a whole conversation later that went with that, which I don't have time to get into. But that's just a way I want you to consider how we think. So as we go into some of the storytellers of our culture, a couple of passages as educators I think are important to just remember. This one from Colossians 4. Pray for us too, that God may, and this is for you, right, as a teacher, that God may open a door for our message. Pray that I may proclaim it clearly as I should. Be wise in the way you act toward outsiders. Sometimes those outsiders are inside your classroom in terms of the way they think. Make the most of every opportunity. Let your conversation always be full of grace, but seasoned with salt, so that you may know how to answer everyone. And I think this is true for your students, but I also think it's true for sometimes your parents as well. How do you have those conversations with parents who their worldview is a couple of bubbles off from where yours was? And probably some of the older teachers in here would probably agree with me. They were a little more in sync a generation or two ago, and now there's a little more variety in terms of why we think the way we do. So a passage like this is sort of a vision for a Christian educator, I think. And also this one from Philippians. Because we live in a selfish and self-centered world, I'll say it this way. Don't do anything out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility consider others better than yourselves. Each of you should not look not only to your own interests, but also to the interests of others. And as a 31-year high school teacher, I'll say this again, send your hate mail, but as a 31-year teacher, I'll say it's hard sometimes to hold back maybe a personal agenda in your classroom for what is actually true and needs to be taught to a kid. Again, my job is to teach truth, and so is yours. My job is not to have my opinions be the rule of the day. So you have to separate out what's truth and what's just my opinion. What's a conviction and what's a preference? And I think it's important, even as Christian educators, we probably start on the same page. How do we, in humility, try to hold back on, I don't want to just have my opinion rule the day here. It's got to be something that's based on truth. So hopefully, the rest of what we talk about in here, you hear from the lens of truth. excuse me. I'm going to scroll here just a minute on this. Just a second. All right, I wanted to show you. I won't make you raise your hands, but the book on the left, it's not written by a Christian. Almost everybody's heard of Jonathan Haidt now. And if you haven't read the book, I think you need to put it on your list. But you definitely have to read the book. Very, very insightful. He's going to be writing more books because the conversation keeps changing. I think as educators, more so than our parents, we need to have our feet in a couple different worlds. We have to have one foot in the world of like what's going on out there in the culture, like what's happening that we need to be aware of so our students, like we can help them. You can't be sort of an ostrich with his head in the sand when you're teaching in a Christian school when it comes to the culture. I don't know is not a good answer when it comes to cultural issues. But you have to have the other foot firmly grounded in something that is true as well. Because if you just lead with the culture, you will be like a windsock and you'll blow whichever way the wind blows on a given day. You have to be grounded in something very scriptural. So to get into your Bibles, I know I'm preaching to the choir, so to speak, but it still needs to be encouraged that we've got to get into what is actually the truth. How do we understand what truth actually is, and then how do we teach it? But I think both of those are important. So I asked my students in high school, and I'll grant you, the sample size is not enormous. I should have maybe sent this out to all of the schools in CEA to say, do this with your high schoolers. But I thought a couple hundred kids was a good starting point. Okay, what are the things that influence your lives the most? Now, I didn't use the word storytellers with them. I just used the word influence with them. Who are those people? And they had a variety of answers, but there was a clear top five, a very clear top two or three and then a top five that was above the rest. So here are the five in total. This is what seniors in high school say. These are the people, these are the things that influence us the most. So I want you to look at that for a second, and then I want you to sort of decide in your mind, like, is this the order of priority they put it in? Or is there one that leads and the others follow? Is this the right order, or is it a disordered list? Do they believe their friends are the most influential people in their lives? And I'll just tell you, this is the order that they put them in. Now, I think sometimes there's a difference between what reality is and how someone perceives it. And I do think that friends needs to be at the top of the list. But it appears to me, and this is maybe where there's a little bit of even confirmation bias, that they ranked their families higher than they should have. I think that, generally speaking, they believe their family should be the most influential, but they're not always as influential as they think they are. I could be wrong about that, for sure, but that's something I would like you to consider as well. What is interesting to me also, because it was a distant fifth, is faith community. Whether that's church or youth group, or they weren't talking about Christian school, because that's a separate issue, but that they put their faith community last, and it was a distant last. So I say this to hopefully, like, we need to, you know, work with and walk with our churches. But as Christian school educators anymore, with all the respect that we can give to our churches, they spend way more time with you than they spend with their church leaders. Way more time. So you have to keep that in mind in terms of faith formation. The church does an outstanding job with the ability that they have to do their job, but they just have limited access. And you have way more. You have 5 days a week for 6, 7 or more hours a day. And I think that can't be understated or overstated enough. So when they say, here's who the storytellers are, well, what about this then? I have parents now who come in regularly to parent-teacher conferences and say a version of this phrase to me. Tell me about my kid. Tell me about my kid. Now, some of them mean it just because, you know, that this is something to say. But when I started teaching, and perhaps it's because I was way younger than I am now, perhaps it was because when I was 25, they figured I didn't know anything anyway, so they would come in and they would often say, let me tell you about my kid. Because I would ask them, can you tell me something about your kid? And, well, let me tell you about my kid. And as the years have gone on, and again, I think there's a part of it that's because I've gotten older too, more and more parents come in with this look of like, can you please tell me something about my kid? I had no idea. Like, I had no idea what's going on with my kid. And I think that's a shift that has affected how they see their stories and how they see the world, the parents and the kids. And some of that is, many of you know because of the classrooms you have, our kids and families are all over the place in terms of just their busyness. They're flying everywhere. And so very many of our students spend very little time with their families in the same house for very long at all. And that has obviously affected the way they understand that dynamic as well. All right, so here's what we'll try to do. I'm going to give you just a quick glimpse into what I believe is some of the considerations that educators need to understand when it comes to families and the stories that come out of our families. And then we'll go into some specific areas where the kids actually bring up, like, here's what we're concerned about. So because they listed it high on the list, I will give you a little bit of, like, okay, storyteller-wise, here's what some kids are saying. And if you notice, I put the word parenting in quotation marks. I did that on purpose, and I just want you to think about this. You may choose to disagree, and I had no problem with that, but we use the phrase parenting a lot. But today in culture, parenting has taken on a very different understanding. Again, definitions matter, right? And Ryan T. Anderson, maybe some of you know who he is, he's a Christian author and writer, he says, I'll quote him, there's no such thing as parenting. There's only mothering and fathering. There's no such thing as parenting. So now, obviously, a lot of our families, there's single parents, there's a single parent home, but almost all of those are by situation and circumstance. God's design for the family, God's intentional design for the family was to have a mother and a father. So when I put parenting there, that's not to discount single parents and the hard work and the hard job that they have, but to say God's intended design is for a mother and a father to raise children. All right? So again, that's something that if you were a large group of secular people in here, I'm pretty sure I'd get some pretty significant pushback on that. I think I would. But I want you to think about that when it comes to how we think about how we teach our kids, especially as they get a little bit older in high school, into high school as well. So, grade school teachers, in here if there are any, raising anti-fragile kids. I think the way we parent kids today in general has changed over the last couple of generations. Almost, in some situations, as a form of idolatry with parents to their children, in the way they sort of see the lens through which they see their kids. And I think the Christian school and the model of a Christian school provides the opportunity to sort of like, how do we understand like what our children for? Okay, how do we understand how to teach children who they are as image bearers of God, instead of to prop them up as not my people, son or daughter, not my, they would never, they always. So to protect them from everything and to keep them from ever failing. I won't make you raise your hands. I know you've had it where a student you have whose parents would never let their child experience anything negative at all. That's called lawnmower parenting or snowball parenting. And it's the worst thing you can do for your child. The best thing you can do as parents in your child's life in terms of teaching them something is to let them fail. They need to fall on their faces. Because it teaches them. And so there's an end result, even when they get into high school or college, we can't let our kids fail. Many of you know this, in high school, a lot of parents today write their kids college application essays, write their scholarship essays for them, because they'll probably do a better job. Of course, now they got AI too, so they got double help, right, to do that kind of stuff. And learning those natural consequences can't be my fault. I'm telling you all things that you know, but I want you to just see it, because that does factor into the way we understand the story, our kids, as they go through high school, and they go through middle school, and even the way they go through grade school. So going back to the high school kids, I asked them this question as well. You guys as seniors, what do you see when you look out into the culture and the people that influence you, the things that influence you? What are the things that you consider to be threats? What are those things that you consider to be the sins that we struggle with as Christian people, if you are a Christian? What complicates your story? What makes it difficult? And they came up with a much shorter list. Now, there was a bunch of singles on this list as well, but they boiled it down to just a few. Right here. I had to categorize in one group the first one, but overwhelmingly, I would say, and I didn't count exactly the percentage, but I'm going to just guesstimate 85% of the kids, the 150 kids who responded to this, put down that for them, the biggest threat and sin in their life was porn, sex, lust, and those kinds of sexual issues. It's an overwhelming issue for a lot of our kids. That was what they listed first. Then worldly temptations, just the other stuff that's out there for them. I listened to the news on the way in this morning. Some of you who listen to sports radio know that this morning there was a breaking story about a gambling ring in the NBA, and there were arrests made of players and coaches in the NBA. That will affect our kids, high school kids and middle school kids. Now, I wasn't LeBron James, okay, so that'll make some kids rest easier, but that sort of stuff, that matters. Again, we're not going to get political in here, but I would just ask, I wonder in your school, how the whole unraveling of the Charlie Kirk assassination kind of unfolded in your school, because there, in our school, this is probably true in every school, there were some adults in the building who had never heard of him before. Literally never heard of him. But there were kids who could barely keep it together when that occurred. So sometimes those things that are influencing our kids, we're not even aware of. And we just don't know because it's off our radar. And so asking these kind of questions, I think, is really important. And that goes to social media as well. Because speaking of Charlie Kirk, he came to sort of prominence mostly through social media. That's how kids got to know him, is through Instagram, right, through TikTok, through all the things that get put out there on YouTube and social media. So these are the things that our students in Christian high schools are saying. And I don't think Unity Christian in Huntonville is tremendously different from any other high school represented at CEA. I think there's differences, obviously, but when it comes to this stuff, I think we're kind of on the same page. So let's start with the start, and I'll take you through a quick tour because I know my time is short here on this one. If you're going to address this, and let me say with in humility, hopefully, I hope you hear this the right way, I think as Christian schools in middle school and grade school and high school, you can be excellent curricularly. You can do a great job with fantastic pedagogy in your school, but if you're not addressing these issues that are outside of your curriculum or your pedagogy in the classroom, then we're doing three-quarters of the job. But we have to tackle these things because they're so prominent in our kids' lives that they have to be addressed. To not do that is to not give our kids the education that I think they really desperately need. And again, could I be wrong? I think so, possibly. But I say that in hopes that we all can think about ways that this affects our kids. So the access points, where and when. I'll just show you this. I've used this slide before. This, as you can see under the Dirty Dozen, it says 24 there. There's a tremendous amount of access. And if you have not paid attention to the news, Roblox has been in the news lately because it was discovered and a lot of arrests have been made where predators, online predators, were specifically using Roblox to groom young kids for sexual purposes. Not necessarily going to kidnap them or abduct them, but just to send pictures. Most grade school kids know how to take a picture on an iPad or a phone, right? So Roblox is one of those that's up there that a parent, for sure, probably through a school, needs to be like, hey, pay attention to this. This is something you need to know. Because the access for this stuff is literally everywhere. COVID, I think, made it worse because of how many of our students kind of went to their computers because they couldn't go anywhere else for a little while. One of the adult, I guess, sites that went way up during COVID is called OnlyFans. Our high school students know about OnlyFans as well, but it's a subscription-based service where basically, if you have an account, you can take pictures of yourselves, of yourself, and you post it to your OnlyFans account. But if I want access to your OnlyFans account, then I have to pay. And depending on how many people access, you know, your account, you make money on that. And that quickly went from pictures to porn. And so it's one of the main ways today that people who want to pay have access to pornographic material because there are superstars on OnlyFans that got famous because of the actual site. 305 million accounts currently on OnlyFans around the world. 305 million. And most of that came after COVID started. So the access for our kids is, and I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but it literally is everywhere. But just to be aware of how we talk about that. Because of that, the age of exposure and when conversations should start. I don't think Devin Burns is in here, but Devin was in here. He's the principal at HCF, Hudsonville Christian. And Devin, before he was at Hudsonville Christian, taught in school and was a principal in Illinois. I forget if it was Illinois or not, but either way, we had a conversation because Devin was a former student of mine. And I went down to the school and he said, well, I want you to talk about pornography with our students. And I was like, okay, what do you want to do? Well, I want you to take the whole day with kids and then at night with parents. Okay, that sounds good, we can do that. What grades are you talking about? He says, well, what do you think? I said, well, it's your school, you tell me. He said, well, I think we should start with kindergarten. I'm like, well, that's interesting. I haven't done that before, kindergarten. But he was right, and I did, kindergarten. Now, you don't use the word pornography because they're kindergartners, but here's what we used. And this should be on the shelf of every Christian school, grade school teacher. Something, maybe you don't use it in class, but maybe you encourage your parents to think about this. They're not Christian books, but they're made for kids to understand the difference between a good picture and a bad picture. Because literally, and I know you're educators, and I know you know this, but sometimes it's good to hear it again. For every single one of our kids, it is not if, it's only when. It's not if, it's only when they're going to have exposure. So assume they all have, especially by high school, they all have. So how do we prepare them for that? That's our job. And the church is not equipped to do that because of the access that they have. You are. Parents are not. Okay, with respect to parents, they're not. You are. And I think we have to start these conversations much, much earlier in schools. I'll give you a contrasting story. I won't tell you the school, because it's not a CEA school. Okay, so everybody's off the hook. But it actually happened. I went to a different school, different state. And when I got there, I was going to do a presentation for middle school kids on pornography. And I got there, and the principal said, thanks for coming, appreciate it. And he said, I want to talk to you for a minute before we start. And I said, no problem, whatever you want, it's your school, I want to respect that for sure. He said, I've been thinking about this a lot, and I want you to do this, but if you please could just not use the word pornography. And I said, what? He said, I'm not comfortable with you using the word pornography with our students, middle school kids. And I said, well, okay, but isn't that what this whole thing's about? Yeah, but I just don't want the kids to hear that word in school from you. And so I didn't, because I respect the school. But how do you do a middle school presentation of pornography without using the word pornography? What do they walk away with? So I said things like bad pictures. I felt like I was talking to a three-year-old, right? But that's what they wanted, because he's afraid of the very, very old sort of argument. If you talk about it, they're going to be interested in it. So I don't talk about it. Because if you talk about it, it's kind of like saying, very serious topic. If you talk about suicide, kids are going to want to take their own lives. Is that right? Well, there's no one in this room who would say, yeah, we shouldn't talk about suicide because otherwise we're going to have kids who are going to want to take their lives, so let's not talk about it. It's kind of ridiculous, but we have to think the same way about this. We have to talk about these things. And then the unthinkable sort of becomes unquestionable in the lives of our students. And some of you here are newer teachers, so you're not that far out of high school and college. So this is in your wheelhouse as well. But what used to be something you would say, that would never happen, is unthinkable. Now it's like, well, of course this is happening. Like, why wouldn't it? So what was unthinkable is now unquestionable. And we have to be aware of that as educators as well. So it should be talked about in your school. Sextortion is a real thing. If you have a high school with more than 20 kids, and one of your kids at least has struggled with or been the victim of a sextortion issue, where someone has asked them for pictures, and they, in a weak moment, sent them, and now we've got a problem. We deal with this every year. I have a boy, almost always, come to me and say, I'm in so much trouble. What do I do? And thankfully, all of those boys, so far, none of them have actually sent any money or tried to actually pay the person who's asking for the money. But it happens all the time because kids are kids and they will make choices that are poor choices. And we don't, you know, suspend those kids or send them home or expel them or tell them how terrible they are. We help them, because if you were in that position, I would probably have had a hard time not maybe doing some of those things as well. So we have to get used to talking about that, but also realizing it's really a real thing. And I think it's been very, very much complicated as well by AI relationships. This is not so much in your schools yet. You should be aware of, most of you have heard of deepfakes before. Deepfakes is when you have a fake, like either body or a head on a person online, a digitally created image. It's more on the dark web than on the actual web yet, but you could find it if you really want to look for it. And I don't talk about this in my class with the kids because I don't want them to know this yet, but there's something called cloth off. And all you need is from any person's social media account. So let's take old people's stuff, Facebook, right? Take Facebook, any picture you find on Facebook, you copy paste a head from a picture on Facebook into cloth off. Cloth off will form a pornographic image, body, everything of that person, and then you send it. Right? So it's happening more and more in schools across America. There have been some arrests made in different public schools, not in Michigan yet. But you should be aware of that. AI is, you know, that's a whole other conversation. It's changing the nature of relationships with how we understand even sexuality as well. Right? And so that's something I think is just to be aware of. And it's replacing for a lot of our kids actual physical interaction with artificial interaction. So there was a student, some of you know, well, I guess two of them, Jordan DeMay, I'll say his name because it's important to say those things. He was a kid who lived in the UP, and he did take his own life because he was sextorted, and he just freaked out in a moment of panic. He took his own life. He lived up in the UP of Michigan, right? And then Jewel Setzer, 14-year-old boy, also took his own life because through AI, he got involved with chatbot, which I'll talk about in just a few minutes here, called Character AI. It's a Google platform. And the bot he was talking to was a Game of Thrones-based character. And that character eventually convinced him that the thing he should do was take his own life, and he did. And their kids, and this was not a kid who had a history of mental health issues, it was just a normal, regular kid. So without like being paranoid about everything, it's good to be aware of everything as well when it comes to these kinds of things. So there's just some examples of those AI sites. And I'm sure you are having battles in your school with how to deal with it as well, educationally. But it's also because of how we deal with it in terms of how they interact with human beings or create things that aren't real, and those become relationships. Right? I think I always encourage my juniors and seniors, if you have a question about a faith-related issue, go to gotquestions.org. It's a great resource for a faith-based question, gotquestions.org. But today, a lot of our students go to AI to ask their questions. And depending on what's behind the AI, they get really bad answers sometimes, like incredibly bad answers. So aware of what's out there, but also aware of what's good that we actually can direct them towards. So that kind of bleeds into a little bit of the social media, the technology conversation as well. Probably nothing you don't already know, but because it's so important to our kids, most kids spend about, today, according nationally, about 8 to 9 hours of screen time a day. That's right now the average in America, 8 to 9. Now, before we start throwing stones at our kids, you should know that on average, parents of high school and middle school kids actually spend more time than that online. So their numbers are actually higher. So if we talk about the influence of parents, if the parents are spending time on their phone, at work maybe too, but it also affects their time with their kids. So at our school, when we have an issue with a student and taking their phone away, or when we did that, then often we get the pushback, the strongest from the parents who had a hard time separating themselves from the phone. It really is interesting to see the parents' phone use related to the kids' phone use and how they possess that phone. It's really interesting to me to sort of study that. So there's one thing. One little nugget here, I learned this from somebody else. The screen size and age of kids is a way to think about this for your parents if you want to have conversations. The smaller the kid, the smaller the frame. Healthier for them. The smaller the kid, the smaller the frame. So all you guys in here, go buy your 85s. You're old enough, right? You're good, right? I had a dad say, well, I can buy an 85-inch TV then, right? Yep, go ahead. But your kids, iPad, phone. I don't glue them to that, but the bigger the immersive experience, the more they're sucked into that and they have a hard time seeing anything else besides what's on that screen. So screen time, sometimes screen size should be small when they're little. Again, that doesn't mean they can do whatever they want in terms of time, but the connection to mental health, 1366, I've used this for as long as it's been relevant, so maybe some of you have heard this from me before. If you want a predictor of mental health when it comes to young people, look at their social media use, the time they spend on social media, and there is a correlation that's pretty significant between those who have the most struggle with mental health and the least struggle with mental health. So those kids who spend the least amount of time on social media, their rate of sort of mental health issues is about 13%. The kids who spend the most time on social media, their rate of mental health issues was 66% of them. So if you want to literally reduce the chances of kids struggling with mental health, reduce their screen time. It literally is, it's not a causation, but it's a correlation. I think it's important to be aware of. The school, the JAMA pediatric study, that's the Journal of the American Medical Association. 2023, they did a study about high schools. They found that in high school, the average student in high school in America today spends 1 hour on their phone during the school day, 1 hour. So that's, however they get that hour, 1 hour. That's the average. So that means some kids spend less, some kids spend more, 1 hour. So when are they carving out the hour to be on their phone during the school day? When is that? That's either during our classes, or it's during break, or both. 1 hour. So that's alone 5 hours a week just during the school day. And the rest of it comes from outside of school. All right. And then this is obviously probably the most controversial issue that we face today in schools is how do we deal with the whole issue of sexuality? And because it's a lightning rod issue, I understand why schools are like, no thanks. I don't want to get a letter. I don't want to deal with it. I get that. But I also get that it's not helping our kids to not talk about this because they have so many questions about this. And sometimes they have such bad information about that. So for schools, Christian schools, I think the primary thing is you have to establish, or a baseline has to be established of how do we start this, and what is our truth? What's our compass heading for this topic? How are we going to talk about it? And I'm not going to go over each one of these things here, but when I say ideas have consequences, maybe some of you have heard this before. Ideas have consequences, bad ideas have victims. So if you have a bad idea and it's sort of propagated, there's going to be victims of that bad idea. You can look at all kinds of parts of culture and see that. So what is true? All right, go back to the 4 points of secular messaging. Happiness is the ultimate goal. Feelings are the ultimate guide. God's the ultimate guest. And judging is the ultimate sin. How do those 4 things fit into the cultural conversation about sexuality? They're all over it. And I think the Christian school is probably literally the best place for young people to understand what is God's truth related to a complicated topic. And I don't want to make it seem like it's easy, but it needs to be spoken, because it just isn't being spoken other places. It just isn't. And I know that's a lot to put on a school, but find a group of people, like, we need to start having this conversation, but we need to know how we're going to have this conversation as well. Like, you don't want to do it without having a plan. So just for example, sex, gender, biology, identity, ROGD. If you don't know what ROGD is, it's rapid onset gender dysphoria. It mostly occurs with middle school to high school age girls. Since that became sort of a growing trend, we started around 2017, there's been a 422% increase in middle schools and high schools in America with girls believing that they were boys. 422% increase. It's called a hockey stick curve. So all other mental health disorders or issues have stayed sort of on a gradual plane, but gender dysphoria has skyrocketed. Why is that? Well, social media does play a role. I'll just give you a quick story. You may think a little differently about this, but I'll say I think I base this in solid truth, but I had a senior girl, wonderful young lady, last year came into my office and said, "Mr. Lindstrom, I need to tell you this because we talk about this in class, okay, this topic, and this is when we were just getting started." She said, "I need to tell you this. I just found out today that there's a huge difference between sex and gender. I just found out today there's a huge difference between sex and gender." So what do you mean by that? I don't think it's always good to start out with a statement to a kid. I think you should ask a question. What do you mean by that? My second question, where did that come from? Where'd you hear that? And I'll let you guess where she got it. Instagram, because she got it from Instagram. It came in an article on Instagram. There is a huge difference between sex and gender. Now, if you're sitting there right now thinking, like, is there? Is there not? Well, then, don't read that article on Instagram. Okay, I'll tell you that, don't read that article. Historically, forever, basically, since God created human beings, there has been no difference between sex and gender. That is a very recent phenomenon. But to suggest that in culture today, you would be branded a bigot, 100%. But I think your kids need to know what's true. I think they do. And I think we have to be okay saying that. Fear is not an option when it comes to this. I think truth is your option. I'll give you something that came out of Colorado. Some of you follow the news on this, but a case in Colorado. Colorado's got some stuff going on. Okay, there's a lot of things happening in Colorado. If you want to sort of push an agenda that probably some of you would have an issue with, Colorado's probably where it's happening already. Whether it's drugs, or whether it's sexuality, or whether it's whatever. Colorado. So this case went to the Supreme Court just about a week or so ago, and it was about upholding a ban on what is called conversion therapy. And if you don't know what that is, conversion therapy is when we're taking someone who is struggling with their sexuality in terms of their transgenderism and saying, okay, let me talk to you about this. Let's make sure that this is something that is like how you got to this point, and maybe saying, like, I don't think what you're dealing with here is actually an issue of transgenderism. I think there's something else going on here. Again, if you did your homework on this, which I'm sure some of you have, mental health issues and transgender individuals, there is such a high correlation between those two. Comorbidities are extremely high with transgender kids and mental health issues. Extremely high. So the conversion therapy, they want to ban in Colorado, and it went to the Supreme Court last week. So how are they going to end up ruling on that? But I want to get you to think about how the language of the culture gets people to think in terms of how they see a story. Historically, when you think of converting somebody, right, you think of changing them. When you think of affirming somebody, you are saying something that is already true about them, right? But in the culture, affirmation is saying something that is different about someone, and conversion therapy is saying something that isn't. So we've taken words that used to mean traditionally one thing, and we've turned them around to mean something different. So now to affirm someone is to say, you're affirmed because even though you think you are this gender, you're actually this gender. We're going to affirm that. It's kind of like the idea of sex assigned at birth that goes with our culture as well. Obviously, you were all born. Was your sex assigned at birth? It was not. It was already there. It wasn't assigned to you. It was confirmed or affirmed, but it wasn't assigned. But that's a common culture thing as well. I think we have to get our kids to think about that. Those are difficult topics, obviously, but I think as Christian educators, man, what an opportunity we have. Carl Truman, I highly recommend reading anything he writes. He said in 2022, the task of the Christian is not to whine about the moment in which he or she lives, but to understand his problems and respond appropriately to them. That's us. And then Romans 12 says, do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Discipleship of the mind is a phrase I love. Discipleship of the mind. Not a go with your gut, trust your feelings, follow your heart. Okay, that frankly is garbage. Discipleship of the mind, your heart and mind, okay, being transformed. So why do we walk away from this? I would suggest to you, as a school, maybe nothing. You walk away with nothing. That's fine. That's okay. I'm glad you're here. But if you think, what do we do? Well, first of all, I think you have to decide on what is the worldview. We all obviously agree on the Bible, but how do we orient that lens? It's very easy to take how we think about something and put that first, so we see our faith through the lens of some issue that we believe in, versus like we see the issue through the lens of faith. Truth starts, the issues come second. During COVID, a lot of good people saw their faith through the lens of politics. That's how they saw it, instead of seeing politics through the lens of faith. And I think that really, really matters. Are those things obstacles or opportunities for us? And depending on your view of that, you have an opportunity, which is huge, to do something amazing in your school. Or it's just like something that's in the way, but I don't know, how are we going to deal with this? What are we going to do? Avoid the naysayers. Avoid that we can't ever do this. You can. You can do it. And then as a school too, I think it's really important to decide, what are we for as a school, but also what are we against? Okay, we got to know what we don't believe. We have to know what we believe, and we have to know what we don't believe. You don't want to be just against things, but you don't want to be for everything so people don't know where your line is either. You have to know. And I think that's really important for all of our schools to recognize. All right, if you have questions or you ever want to email a question, that is my email address at Unity. I try to respond as quickly as possible to those. And I really am basically out of time. So thank you so much for being here today. I appreciate your time, and have a good rest of the day.